Welcome to the Farmers Weekly Podcast, this episode recorded on Friday the 26th of February 2021. From the Farmers Weekly News Desk, I'm Johan Tasker.
And I'm Hugh Broom.
In this week's episode, as lockdown demand for pets surges, criminals target farm dogs.
Fed them all at 8 o'clock. We came back the next morning, half past 7, and they'd all gone. The pups had gone and the collie bitch was just left run free, basically.
Labour warns of an economic shock to small family farms.
The accelerated removal of direct payments and the rather confused picture around what will replace it with the Elm scheme will put small family farms out of business.
In the markets, lamb surges again.
And we visit the rural book club that's bringing hundreds together during lockdown.
I feel that book club is the best thing to come out of lockdown, and it has proven how people from different geographic areas can come together online.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
But first, last week we reported that growers had voted to stop paying levies to AHDB Horticulture, the sector body which oversees millions of pounds worth of horticultural research. Well, now farmers are to be given a vote on whether to stop paying levies to all other AHDB sector bodies, including pigs, dairy, beef and lamb, cereals and oilseeds. DEFRA Secretary George Eustace told this week's NFU conference that he will honour the horticulture vote and extend the ballot to farmers in other sectors too.
Some of the larger horticultural producers were more supportive of maintaining the current turnover levy, but it was a clear majority against. And so we will, you know, respect the outcome, obviously, of that particular ballot. I think there's any question, which is, what else might you do in this space to help support the horticultural sector? And I think in particular, there's a lot of support and interest in the work they do, for instance, on emergency authorizations. So could there be a model where people would, for instance, subscribe to the AHDB in order to get access to emergency authorizations they might secure? So we're investigating that. And we're also looking at whether there could be a convening role for the AHDB in marshalling some of the new funds we plan to have under the R&D syndicates, which will be targeted at individual businesses and individual sectors. So we're exploring, you know, a range of different options so that we can keep those elements of the work that AHDB did that I think were valued, but also obviously respect the results and remove the current turnover levy that exists.
Mr. Eustace went on to say that he's in talks with AHDB Chairman Nicholas Sapphire on the timetable for votes on whether levies should continue in other sectors.
I know there's a vote coming up on the potato sector as well. I mean, I would just say I think Nicholas Sapphire has done a fantastic job over the last 12 months to really pull the AHDB together to develop a new strategy. That's very well received. I'm getting lots of positive comments about that. What I will be doing, and we consulted on this, is working with AHDB and Nicholas to agree a timetable to have ballots for all of the remaining sectors. Because I think what we really need to do now is, having got that plan, the strategy to reform and change the AHDB, actually put that to all members in all sectors, and we'll be doing that in due course.
That's DEFRA Secretary George Eustace.
So, Johan, it seems everyone's going to get a vote now on all of the levies.
That's completely right. We knew that it was going to be a vote on AHDB potatoes. George Eustace has now confirmed that all the levy boards, all the sector boards, are going to have a vote on the future of the levy for their particular sectors.
The big problem here, though, is they haven't got a clue where half the levy payers are. I mean, if you look at red meat, if you look at cereals, these are processor-collected levies. So on the animals at the abattoir, for example, or at the mill for the wheat and the arable commodities, they haven't got a scooby who these people are. So how can you have an election, a ballot, on a levy, democratically representative, when you don't actually know who you're sending the ballot papers to? It's not going to work.
Well, that's the interesting thing, isn't it? I was talking to somebody from AHDB before Christmas, and they were saying exactly that. When it comes to, say, like you say, meat or something like cereals, you know, how do you know who's entitled to vote and who isn't? Because there doesn't, to me anyway, there doesn't seem to be any sort of central record telling you who that producer or who that grower is.
Perhaps this is where, once again, I roll out my PLC model with the slight nuance of statutory levy collection. So the only bit of legislation that stays the same is the statutory levy collection. That stays the same. But as soon as it drops into the account for red meat or cereals or whatever, then it becomes effectively what is a levy payer owned PLC. So if they want to spend the money on something, they can tomorrow without having to go through the minister and all the red tape. It won't take them 15 years to decide what colour to paint the office walls. Boom, it can happen tomorrow. So to get them to vote in the ballot, you basically offer them the free shareholding in the new organisation, get registered, get on the drum, and you can be a part of it. And if they don't register and no one bothers, then you walk away, I suppose. I don't know.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting, isn't it? Because I think, you know, are people going to be able to walk away? Are they not? I think the whole of this thing has been the compulsory nature of it, and that growers, especially in horticulture, possibly in potatoes as well, we've got to wait to see for the result on that one. You know, people being forced to pay this money without, as they see it, any representation or enough representation. So that's something that's got to be resolved.
But that's why you want the business-like PLC model, because then people can decide where the money is spent. And let's face it, you can't have it as a discretionary thing, because if you do, and they think too, I mean, the minister touched on it in his piece about, you know, emergency EMUs on pesticides and stuff like that, and doing that regulatory work and people paying, you know, a sub into the pot and then benefiting just from that. But if it's discretionary, you're never going to get the numbers, the size of money that you need to do some really important independent R&D, be it in agronomy or animal science or whatever, which no one else can do or no one else will pay for in the market. And equally, it's all the other sort of, you know, we'll hear about it a bit later on in this podcast. It's the sort of seed planting stuff, the going out finding new markets that no one commercially is going to do. So it's those sort of risk bridges that HDB can cross for small, modest sums, and then hand it over to the commercial sector when things flourish. So having a discretionary tax just will not work.
Well, that's what George Eustis, in my mind, is that's what he's talking about, though. I mean, he's saying that the vote was clear, that it was a straight result. He acknowledged that some of the larger horticultural producers were more supportive of maintaining the turnover levy, but he did say that there was a clear majority against, and he will respect the outcome of the ballot. So we'll have to sort of wait and see how it goes, because he acknowledges, too, that there are valuable bits of the AHDB and the work that they do. People value that, but also, you know, some people just don't want to pay the amount of levy or pay for things that they feel are not worthwhile.
We will have to see how it develops. Watch this space.
Hi, I'm Natalie Wood, Yara's country arable agronomist. Crops got off to a good start in the autumn with favourable establishment conditions, and many were quite advanced heading into the winter. However, with above average rainfall levels in December and January, there is a risk that their root systems have taken a knock due to sitting in wet anaerobic conditions. The last thing we want is to have good above ground growth without the same below ground growth to sustain it. In order to regrow that root system, fresh phosphate and potassium are vital nutrients to go with our nitrogen and sulphur at that first application timing. Applying an NPKS product such as Yaramila Activa S at the first nitrogen timing will give the crop the vital nutrients it requires by A, providing immediately available nutrients so the crop can take them up quickly and efficiently, and B, grow that root system back to sustain the top growth. The second and or third dressing can then be an NS product such as Yaravella Axan. For more information, please visit yara.co.uk.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
Now, also at NFU conference this week was Trade and Industry Secretary Liz Truss, who used the event to launch a government campaign to boost exports of British food and drink. We wanted to ask her how much this initiative would benefit British farmers, or whether it would mainly benefit food processors and drinks manufacturers. Liz Truss was good enough to give us 5 minutes of her time on the phone after her speech, but before I started the interview, I explained to her that if she could hear anything untoward in the background, that I was working from home, I'm homeschooling, and my 12-year-old son Henry is having a trumpet lesson a couple of rooms away. Anyway, she was very understanding, and here is the interview with Liz Truss, accompanied for the first 30 seconds or so, if you've got good hearing, by Henry on his trumpet. And I started by asking Liz Truss how much money the government was pumping into this export initiative.
We're putting £2 million into the export campaign. We're also making sure that we reorganise our resources in DIT to have a greater focus on food and farming, and also in our international markets as well.
And in terms of boots on the ground abroad in emerging markets, perhaps, will there be people out there, sort of ambassadors for British food and farming? Yeah,
we already have agriculture councillors overseas. We will, of course, look at increasing that resource over time, because we have now taken on responsibility for those roles from what was done by the European Commission. We also have, of course, trade experts in country who are responsible for breaking down those market access barriers and also giving support to companies. So, you know, in the last year alone, we've seen the ban on British beef into the US lifted. So I went on a virtual tour with the Foyle Food Group, seeing what they're doing exporting into the United States market. They're also exporting into countries like the Philippines and Vietnam. And I think there's a real opportunity for more companies to follow in their footsteps. And we know that companies that export pay higher wages, they're more productive. And ultimately what this is about is bringing more income into British farming.
And it will benefit farmers. It will sort of trickle down, I guess. This is not just about sort of high value food and drinks manufacturers, people like Scottish Salmon, Scottish Whiskey. This is for ordinary farmers as well, as it were.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's a lot of parts of the animal we don't eat here in the UK, but are very much in demand in the rest of the world. You know, the prices for products like beef are higher in Asia than they are in Europe. So there really are great opportunities for companies to go out there and use. And, you know, I mentioned the Foyle Food Group, but I think there's, you know, 5,000 farmers that use the Foyle Food Group for their exporting. So, you know, and David Stowe, obviously the cheese manufacturer in Cornwall, you know, they have dairy farmers across Cornwall and Devon that are benefiting from the fact that David Stowe are exporting their cheddar into the Canadian and US market. So this is all about the UK being high in the value chain to make sure that we are bringing more funds into UK farming and ultimately more jobs into the industry. I think New Zealand's a very good example. New Zealand produces 3% of the world's milk, but it has 30% of the global dairy market in terms of value. And the UK is a high welfare, high standard quality producer, and we should be able to command those kind of high value products around the world.
Secretary of State Liz Truss, thank you very much.
Some very positive work there from the International Trade Minister, Johan.
Yeah, and Henry's trumpet playing wasn't too bad either. Look, I think that this, I think what Liz Truss is doing, you know, she's come a long way as a senior politician. You know, she was, of course, an internet meme at one point, talking about opening up pork markets at the Tory party conference. You know, this is serious stuff, Hugh. I think it could benefit farmers, of course. There will be this sort of trickle-down effect. The question is how much, especially when you look at sort of commodities such as things like oilseed rape, things like wheat, that kind of thing. I think, you know, I get what she says, but I do think this is probably a little bit more to do with higher-value products rather than commodities.
Exactly, but the key thing, I think the fascinating figure in there is the New Zealand figure. You know, they produce 3% of the world's milk, but 30% of the value. I mean, that's a phenomenal figure. And I think it's great that the, you know, they're thinking in along those terms. And if we can start to think about that with all these, particularly, I suppose, on the animal products, where you can really add some value in terms of the processing. And it could be on arable products as well, I suppose, if you find the right process or create the right bread that everyone wants or whatever it happens to be. If government is fully behind that and is doing everything it can to expedite the export of that into new markets, finding new markets, and they're investing the resource in doing that, that's a great thing. We just obviously got to wait and see what happens in terms of where those numbers go. But it's going to definitely have a trickle-down effect. And if it stabilises, for example, a dairy market in a certain area, you know, David Stowe Cheese is a good example. If the farms, you know, that are supplying that creamery are able to carry on doing what they're doing and it's a good steady trade, then great. Well, you know, I think it's good effort all round.
I mean, one thing I would point out, though, is that I think the food and drink sector in this country is the largest manufacturing sector, as the NFU often points out. And indeed, NFU President Minette Batters pointed it out at the NFU conference where Liz Truss delivered or launched this export initiative. One thing I would point out, $120 billion, this export drive is only £2 million. Sounds like a lot of money. It is, you know, not all of us are millionaires. But if you look at it in proportion to the total value of the sector, it's not a lot at all. And I think, you know, there will need to be more money put into this to do it justice.
But the key thing is, if you can, you know, £2 million, it doesn't seem a lot in comparison to the total value of the output. However, strategically placed, you know, one thing, okay, let's go back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago with HDB. One thing HDB have been really good at doing is this strategic marketing and getting into new markets, sending little quiet delegations to go and look around a country, suss out a market, and then quietly just go in there. It's a relatively low cost exercise. It's about people. It's people on people. Getting in there, finding out where the markets are, and then presenting the product. And boom, before you know it, you've opened something up. You don't need great huge amounts of money and fanfares to do it. You might do it at the big launch at the end of the negotiation, but the initial fact-finding, the initial market awareness or seeing where the market opportunities are, it's what businesses everywhere around the world do every day. And they do that, you know, fairly cutely and in a fairly low-cost way. So if government is supporting that work, and the key thing, government is supporting the risky bit, because those are the risky bits that, you know, commercial business may not be prepared to send someone out to a country for a month to go and suss out a market because it costs them. If government underwrites that bit and then hands it into the commercial players, fantastic.
I'm Darren Hobbs, agricultural contractor from Taunton, Somerset. Bought my first Massey Ferguson baler last year. Contract baling is a competitive market, so we have to operate a baler which is capable of making consistent good bales in almost any condition, so we can rely on our Massey Ferguson.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
Okay, so how about this? You wait a few weeks to hear a heavyweight politician on the Farmers Weekly podcast, and then three come along at once. Labour leader Keir Starmer told NFU Conference this week he wanted to forge a closer relationship with farmers, saying it was long overdue.
If you can believe it, this is the first time a Labour leader has addressed the NFU Conference since 2008, 13 years ago. And I think that's perhaps indicative of the perceived distance that's grown up between Labour and the countryside.
Mr. Starmer then announced that Labour's Shadow DEFRA Secretary Luke Pollard would be conducting a complete review of the party's policies for agriculture. Mr. Pollard told us he was particularly concerned about the future for small family farms.
The accelerated removal of direct payments and the rather confused picture around what will replace it with the ELM scheme will put small family farms out of business. If you think about those smaller family farms that might have, you know, 50, 60% of their income based on existing farm payments, the decision of the government to phase them out without really a clear roadmap about how they'll be replaced, I think will put those farms directly in financial trouble.
We asked Mr. Pollard whether this meant Labour would retain direct payments or simply phase them out more slowly.
That will be part of the review that I'll be undertaking. But broadly, I'm concerned that the speed in which direct payments are being phased out will create economic shock for farmers, won't give farmers the time to adjust. I'm also concerned that not all the money that is being proposed as going into the ELM scheme will actually get to farmers. I'm worried about how much of it will be siphoned off by consultants and by folks who don't have farming as their core business.
That's Labour Shadow DEFRA Secretary Luke Pollard. The government insists there will be no cliff edge for farmers as direct payments are phased out. DEFRA Secretary George Eustace.
We recognise that there is currently a dependency on direct payments for some businesses and that many would lose money if those were taken away overnight. That is why we will phase out subsidies for land tenure or ownership over a 7-year period, giving businesses and land rents time to adjust to the market.
That's DEFRA Secretary George Eustace. So Hugh, the last time that an opposition leader spoke at an NFU conference was 13 years ago. Too long or too soon for a return?
It was a long time ago. I was there. It was 2008. It was Gordon Brown when he was Prime Minister. And he, bless him, every time he addressed a farming audience, and he probably still to this day recalls the childhood holidays he had on his grandfather's farm. I've heard that many times. But yes, it was 2008. Perhaps it is too long. But then again, I wouldn't imagine that that Jeremy Corbyn probably wouldn't have been the first to run into an NFU conference. That would have been quite an interesting speech, wouldn't it? Anyway, yes, it's great that Keir Starmer is acknowledging that farming and agriculture exists. And let's not forget, historically, actually, if you go back and look at what's happened in agriculture, if we say spool back the last 70, 80 years to the around the World War II and onwards, all that when Labour has been in power, farming has actually done okay, believe it or not, because what's tended to happen, I think, is that perhaps Labour governments don't understand farming as well as, I don't know, other party governments. And they tend to just throw stuff at it and let it get on and then throw a bit of money at it or throw a bit of legislation at it. You know, tenancy reform. There are lots of things that have happened under Labour governments which have actually benefited farmers quite well over the last few decades.
I think there is a school of thought, look, that, and we know, yes, lots and lots of farmers votes Conservative. The Conservative Party is almost the party of the countryside. I think there is a school of thought that says that the Tories can more or less do what they want, and farmers will vote Conservative anyway. Labour, of course, has to try a lot harder. It's ostensibly it's an urban-based party. I was looking on Twitter this week, and Ed Barker from the AIC, who's a complete sort of policy geek, as it were, he tweeted about this. He tweeted a map of the constituencies, and the countryside is more or less a sea of blue. The Labour Party has to win some of those seats if it wants to win power. So it's going to be doing what it can to show that it has rural interests, it has farming interests at its heart. So it will be interesting to see the sort of stuff that comes out of this review. And speaking to Luke Pollard about it, and he said it will involve consultation with farmers. They do want to get out there, coronavirus restrictions aside. They do want to get out there. They do want to have this conversation with farmers. They want to meet them face to face, see what's going on, and devise policies, especially relating to small family farms, that are beneficial, and understand where growers and livestock producers are coming from.
Indeed, Johan, you look at the wider rural context. Yes, there are many constituencies that need to turn from blue to red for them to win. But actually, in terms of farming votes, it's minuscule. It's not even 0.2 points. I think it's in 0.2% of the electorate actually have a farming vote. So we get a reasonable shout round the table, given the importance of the job that we do. But that said, in terms of a great political entity, we're not like the French farmers or some of even the American farmers that really can swing an election either way. The other thing to pick up on there, Labour have this fascination and have had this commentary for some while talking about protecting small family farms, which is fantastic and very virtuous. However, what is the definition of a small family farm? I remember at NFU conference several years ago, the then opposition spokesman being pushed on this, he hadn't got a Scooby. You know, you could argue a small family farm business or a family farm business could be 5,000 acres or it could be 250 acres. They are both family entities. They are both farm and farm business types that we need to conserve and needs to go on and needs to thrive. So where do you draw the line? What is small? What is large? And how do you differentiate on that one? In terms of their policy, you know, they haven't got long to get together. Because if you think about it, we've got an election coming up in 2024, scary as it may seem, only 3 years away. You've got probably, 12 months to pull your policy together? Because then it's a slow, steady trot 2 years into the election, sort of telling people what your policy is and pushing that forward. So they need to get their their skates on in terms of pulling that policy together. And the fact that they're opening it up, does it give you an impression that they've really got any idea which way it's going? I don't know, but get in there, have your say, create Labour's policy for them.
Yeah, I was asking Luke Pollard, I said to him, was there sort of clear blue water or indeed clear red water between their policies and the Tory policies? And he insisted that there were. I mean, he did voice something which a number of Farmers Weekly readers have been concerned about, whether they vote Conservative, whether they vote Labour, and that is the impact on their incomes of withdrawing these direct payments, withdrawing them over 7 years, when we don't actually know the full detail yet as to what's going to replace them in terms of this environmental land management scheme.
Absolutely. And look, all they're doing is echoing what we've been saying for months, weeks, years, that the lack of detail and clarity is a disturbing one when you're trying to ban a business, plan a business going forward for the next 5, 10 or even 15 years. I suppose, look, this should be what the opposition does. After all, don't forget, we pay for the opposition, OK? They get their MP's wage, but there's a fat load of money goes into 5, 6, 7 million quid that pays for the opposition to do just that, to call the government to account. So it could be argued that, are they doing that hard enough? And are they making any impact in terms of any government decisions that happen? I mean, it's difficult when you've got a government with a majority of 80 to do that. But there are certain things that really do need calling out. And one of the things, I say, as we've been saying, is this complete still. Even after all the policy the talk of this week, NFU conference, we are still completely in the dark. We still haven't got a scoopy what the timeline really will be. And more importantly, what the money will look like. Is the budget going to be a fiver or is it going to be 3 billion? We just don't know. So that is what the opposition should be concentrating on teasing out of the government now.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
You are indeed listening to the Farmers Weekly Podcast. Welcome along wherever you happen to be listening to us, or whenever. That's the beauty of podcasts, isn't it, Johan? Whenever you happen to be listening to us in the relevant and current week that the podcast is in. Here's the thing, Johan. If you are listening, podcast people, to this, listeners, please, can you advise a farming friend of yours how to listen to podcasts, okay? Because it's become blatantly apparent to me that there are many people out there, our potential audience members, who are very savvy, clever business people, running farm businesses, doing farm things, haven't got a scooby about podcasts. Have you come across that, Johan?
I have actually, yeah. And I mean, the beautiful thing about them, of course, is that you can listen to them in many different ways in many different places, in your tractor cab, in the farm office, in the dairy parlour. We know that people do, in the kitchen. You know, you can even listen
in a field,
lying in bed at night. In a field, yeah. And you can listen to them on Apple, on Spotify, on Farmers Weekly Interactive, on your smart speaker. We know that there are even people who listen to them to the podcast via their televisions. So, yeah, wherever you are, listen to the Farmers Weekly podcast and tell your friends about it, because the numbers are going up, but we would like to see them even higher.
The thing is, it's really important that you explain to your potential podcast listening friend how podcasts actually work, because it's surprising also the number of people who don't actually get the concept that it's a bit of audio you can listen and wherever, whenever. And look, as we sit here at the end of February, for many, poised just on the edge of a precipice, about to undergo a sort of life sentence of spring cultivation work, which is about to happen, and they could be sat in their cab, happily power harrowing up and down endless acres of maize ground, listening to podcasts. So share with them that joy and the fact that they've become entertained and invigorated by doing it. Don't forget also, please continue to send in your wonderful reviews via Apple Podcasts or Spotify or however else you want to do that. And of course, if you want to get in touch with us, you can, even if it's just to say hello to you whilst you are enduring that long and arduous spring cultivations campaign. You go to podcast@fwi.co.uk. That's podcast@fwi.co.uk.
Right, Hugh, time for the markets. What's going on?
Thank you, Johan. Finnish steer deadweight price this week. The average GB deadweight price is 374.3. That's marginally back on last week, although, as we'll hear in a minute, We have seen instances where that's gone up significantly in little spots, but that's the average this week, 374.3. The live weight average on steers is back about 3p this week, 210 a kilo. Now, sheep, just unbelievable movement in the sheep price again this week. The deadweight average, SQQ, for this week is 609.1. That's up nearly 12, 13p on the week from last week. Live weight stays much the same, 278.5. We'll talk more about those sheep prices in a minute. To the arable commodities, feed wheat's just edged up £3 this week, 200 pounds and 90p will buy you a tonne of feed wheat. That's up from 197.80 last week. Milling wheat edges up about a quid, 214.60 this week. Feed barley edges back up again by another pound, 158.80. And oilseed rape continues to rise once more, just below the 400 mark at the moment. But this week, the average oilseed rape price bid was 397.70. That is up about £5 on the week before. Now, back to those cattle and, more importantly, those sheep prices. We talked about it last week because it's, we thought it was unprecedented. It's done it again. It's jumped another 12 or 13p. It's just unbelievable. Here to talk about that and also to talk about bull sales, which have been taking place this week at Stirling and at Carlisle over last weekend, is Farmers Weekly's Michael Priestley. Michael, what were the sales like?
Trade seemed to reflect the current relative confidence in the beef market, Hugh, and it seemed to prices were up. If we look at the averages, Carlisle limbs, they were up just over £1,400. Shorthorns were up just over £1,300. Anguses were up 679, and the limousines at Stirling were just up just over £1,000 on the year.
And back to these lambs, Michael, they're still going up in value.
It's remarkable, isn't it? I think that the deadweight price has just caught up with the live weight from a week or two back, and we're now seeing kind of a lot of deadweight prices over sort of 600 pence a kilo, and probably, yeah, around about 610. So that's possibly a bit of a legacy of the snow and the cold weather slowing down growth rates and maybe getting putting people off drawing lambs, possibly. 77 pence up on the year is the deadweight average, which is £15.40 on a 20-kilo carcass. So that's making your kind of star lamb that was maybe bought for £10, £12, £15 more. It's kind of on parity, really. This week in the live, prices are just back a shade.
And cattle prices, plenty of demand there. The averages we talked about earlier probably don't reflect the demand and possibly what's happened in the market in the last few days, Michael.
Very tight. People are being rung very late in the evening by processors, yes. I've heard of cattle going from Aberdeen to Shrewsbury, £3.90 for commercials. You know, larger feeders are seeing that in kind of northern England. An Angus at £4.415, £3.80 for 90, £3.90 for commercials is quite common, and certainly Angus went over 400 pence. And people are sort of talking that, well, folk are that short that they'll be at £4 for commercials as well.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
Incidents of dog theft have seen an unprecedented rise in the last year. It's thought that the surge in cases is driven by the demand for pet dogs that's occurred since the first lockdown last spring. Many farmers have been victims of the crime, and one petition is calling on government to make dog theft a specific offence with a prison sentence of 8 years. That's now been signed by over 150,000 people. William Bevan is a shepherd from Stow-on-the-Wold and had a litter of puppies stolen 2 weeks ago.
We had them in a stable block, a horse stable block. We fed them all at 8 o'clock. We came back the next morning, half past seven, and they'd all gone. The pups had gone, and the collie bitch was just left run free, basically. We left the door open and let her run. So you just can't believe this happened to you, really. I described it the other day to a friend of mine. I lost my dad very suddenly. And it's the same sort of feeling. It's like somebody punched you in the stomach. It's just a loss, really. It's horrible.
Alan Davis is the NFU County Advisor in Carmarthenshire and Glamorgan, where there's been a recent spate of thefts.
I think it's all dogs, if I'm honest with you, be it a working sheepdog right down to a pet poodle. I think obviously there's a real demand for dogs at this point in time, and I think thieves are working to supply demand.
He went on to say that thieves are careful to monitor the movements of dog owners.
They do come whenever a farmer leaves, or be it when they goes to bed, etc. That's when, you know, it usually does happen in the night, because obviously that's when they know they'll be in their beds, etc. But it can happen any time of the day, unfortunately. It takes 2-3 years for someone to train their dog up to be what they want it to be, etc. But also, can't take away as well the fact that family dogs are getting stolen as well, causes huge grief, I should say, along with the working dogs as well.
Farmers Weekly journalist Debbie James has been looking at the problem. She joins me now. Debbie, how big a problem is this across the whole of the UK?
It's a growing problem. It's certainly over the last 12 months, the police have been reporting much greater incidents of dog theft from right across the country, really. And, you know, we're seeing all kinds of animals being stolen, from sheepdogs to hunterways, kelpies, working dogs. You know, those are the dogs that are being targeted.
And what can be done to try and cut the risk of your dog being stolen?
There's all sorts of things that farmers can do. Making sure that the dogs are microchipped. If the dog's recovered, then the owner can be traced. Not to leave a dog unattended and out of sight, you know, perhaps in the cab of a vehicle. Opportunists, thieves might, you know, take that opportunity to steal a dog.
And it seems, Debbie, that the police really have got their work cut out trying to trace these stolen dogs.
Only a minority of stolen dogs are reunited. You know, there's a few that have happy endings. I spoke to one Welsh farmer whose dogs, I think he had 4 stolen, and they were recovered following a police operation. But, you know, the police, in all the situations I spoke to, the farmers praised the actions of the police, but a lot of the dogs, sadly, go unrecovered.
That's Farmers Weekly journalist Debbie James, and her article about dog thefts is in this week's Farmers Weekly on page 16 and 17.
Hugh, we know these dogs are being stolen. Do we know where they're ending up, though?
No, no one seems to know, and it's really weird, isn't it? Because I was thinking, so the working dogs, for example, if someone came up your drive and said, here, mate, do you want to buy a, you know, really good collie for 500 quid? You just wouldn't do it, would you? I don't know any farmer that would buy a dog like that. I think one thing people think they might be doing is they're being used for breeding, basically. There was one dog described that came back to it. It was a dog that was recovered. It was found and recovered and went back to the owners. And then they realised it was a female dog, that it was actually in pup. So the thought there is that they may have been stolen to be used as breeding bitches. But whether they're being taken abroad or that's happening to them, the whole thing's terrible. It's really bad and obviously really upsetting for the owners, whoever they may be, you know, households, farms or whoever.
And I guess you know, a lot of these dogs are going to be worth a lot of money, especially the working dogs. But it's all about, that's not just based on what they do, it's based on their pedigree. And if you've not got the documentation and that kind of thing, I think, you know, the sad thing is that these dogs are going to be stolen and they're going to be sold on for a fraction of what they're worth. So it's disgusting, really.
No, it's an awful thing. Look, the big thing, it's like everything around crime. It's about information. It's about being perceptive. It's about identifying if suspicious behaviour, vehicles. And the most important thing with anything to do with rural crime is sharing it. You know, if you haven't got a WhatsApp group set up in your local community of farmers, rural people, gamekeepers, whatever, get one set up. You pass each other, you know, in your truck going from A to B every day and probably wave. And in the normal times, you might only actually sit down in the pub and have a proper chat every couple of 3 weeks. At the moment, no one's sitting down chatting at all, other than on the phone or on a blooming Zoom meeting. So yeah, just share the intel. If you see something suspicious, no matter how minor it is, just share with the police, with your neighbours, with colleagues, with friends, with employees, and keep that culture going, because that's the one way that you can start to deter things, and things can change for the better.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
And finally, an online book club for farming and the countryside is attracting hundreds of members, and some famous authors too. Adam Bedford, who lives in York, set up the Fieldwork Book Club after asking people to post pictures of the books they enjoy reading on Twitter.
There was a huge response, and then before we knew it, an online book club was born, and we decided to read James Rebank's new book, English Pastoral, first. And we did a Zoom call that 140 people joined to hear James Rebank talk about his book.
And that's got to be something special, hasn't it? To get somebody like James Rebanks to come along and do a talk about his book. I mean, he's very much the man of the moment when it comes to writing about food and farming in the countryside.
Yeah, and one of the best things, which, you know, could has gone probably better, you know, than I could have ever expected, is that the whole idea is of this, that we're in such changing times in agriculture and food and the environment, that this is an opportunity for farmers to come together with environmentalists, with members of the public, because we're all trying to work out, you know, what comes next. And if you do that through a book, you know, not everybody has to agree. You don't have to read all of the book. You don't have to join every month. But when we get to the discussion at the end of the month, basically people are just having an open discussion around these big issues that are facing us all, coming from different backgrounds. And that's one of the best bits of it. It's open to everybody. And people, which I'm delighted about, seem to be really enjoying that interaction that they're having with people to get different perspectives, which is what it should be all about.
Book Club founder Adam Bedford. Sarah Morris is one of the Book Club members.
For me, I feel that Book Club is the best thing to come out of lockdown, and it has proven how people from different geographic areas can come together online. And yeah, it's absolutely brilliant to have people from all around the UK and America coming together in one place with a shared love of the topic, with a glass of wine, let's be honest, and meet complete strangers and talk about fantastic books.
Sarah Morris. Carolyn Steele, author of the book Sitopia, about how food can save the world, said talking to Book Club members was a fantastic experience.
It's really great, actually, because I often speak to an audience who doesn't think much about food or farming from one year to the next. And of course, this is a very highly knowledgeable audience. And I don't think I've ever spoken to that many farmers, probably. So it was really great. It was a really lively discussion. We all had a glass of wine in our hands or a beer. And I think we all felt we could have gone on a lot longer. I mean, in fact, we ended up sort of saying, we need to do this for real sometime in a pub. It was fab.
And what's your book, Sitopia, about?
It's about really how food shapes our lives and world, and how, therefore, we can use food as a lens to really understand all the problems that we face at the moment, everything from climate change to mass extinction to diet-related disease to COVID, through food, because food is really the principal thing that connects us to nature and also to one another. So it's this very powerful force shaping our lives.
That's author Carolyn Steele. Now, if you want to join the Fieldwork Book Club, simply send an email to fieldworkbookclub@gmail.com. And we'll put that email address on the show notes page of this episode of the Farmers Weekly podcast.
It seems that you have to have a glass of wine or a beer, though, in your hand whilst you sat in front of the computer talking about books.
Yeah, it was interesting how often alcohol crops up in that little clip there, wasn't it? I mean, a glass of wine, a glass of beer in one hand, book in the other. I think the great thing about this, Hugh, is that you actually get to talk to the author as well. And that's something that, you know, in a book club where there's sort of six of you sitting around a table or whatever, that's extremely unlikely to happen. But to actually have the author there talking to you and discussing the book, I mean, that's absolutely great.
And obviously, hearing from the author's perspective, really fascinating for them to be face-to-face with 140-odd readers, particularly in their subject matter as well. So, it sounds like a really good thing. And you're going to put the note that you're going to put the joining instructions on the podcast notes.
Yeah, we'll do that, and we'll probably put links to the couple of authors, James Rebanks and Carolyn Steele, as well, so you can find out about them. But yeah, we'll certainly do that.
Brilliant. Now, next week, what have we got coming up?
Next week, Hugh, we hope to have news from the government's trade advisor. This is Tim Smith, the head of the Trade and Agriculture Commission. His report is due out imminently. We think it's going to be early March. It could be next week. He's going to be warning against a race to the bottom on food standards when it comes to imports. So this is really, really good to hear, and he's going to hold the government to account.
We'll look forward to that, but in the meantime, thank you so much for listening. This has been the Farmers Weekly podcast. Please don't forget, if you did like what you hear, do give us a decent review. It really helps, and it means a lot as well for all the work that goes into it. But in the meantime, until next week, I'm Hugh Broome. Goodbye.
And I'm Johan Tusker. Goodbye.